seen some dramatic changes just in the last 3 or 4 hours today, and right now it's pretty dynamic.
The ice jam starts breaking up near Galena. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the federal government tells communities in Southeast to return money.
The revenues that we've given you, that you anticipated, that you budgeted for, we're going to claw that back, for heaven's sakes.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The ice jam that is causing devastating flooding in the Yukon River community of Galena is slowly starting to break up. National Weather Service hydrologist Ed Plum says he first saw signs it was crumbling late this morning. He says this afternoon, large pieces are starting to break off the front of the ice jam.
The ice behind that section of the jam isn't moving downriver yet, but it's any time now we should see the ice that's been backed up behind this jam for over 3 days start to move downriver. So it's looking like today or later today we'll see the ice start moving up here in Galena and hopefully push all the ice out, flush it down the river, and start to see the water recede in Galena.
But Plum says the water could still rise before that happens.
When we were in the air, we talked to one resident who's still in his house by aviation radio, and the water is at its highest point it's been in this flood so far, and he is continuing to have the water rise at his house slowly.
And Plum says the water is within inches of cresting the dike around the airport.
They've gone around and they're adding material to the lowest points on the dike where the water is near the top. And, you know, if the water does rise here in Galena, you know, over a foot, 6 inches to a foot, we may see some water spill over the top of the dike.
Plum says the airport area is lower than the surrounding water and only protected by the earthen dike. He says the walled area, which includes the runway, former Air Force base buildings, a school dorm, and a tank farm, is providing a last refuge from surrounding devastation. Plum says there's debris and fuel floating on the water. He says if the jam gives way suddenly, a slug of water and ice will move toward the downstream villages of Koyukuk and Nulato, where some residents have already evacuated as a precaution. Koyukuk residents are monitoring river conditions on a bluff near the town.
They've been preparing for the last, many days they've been preparing for high water, especially once this jam formed and they knew there was a bunch of water piled up back behind it and flooding a large area.
Most residents of Galena have evacuated, but State Emergency Manager David Lee says some people have refused to leave.
They have places that are higher in the houses, like second stories and stuff. They've pretty much accepted that it's happened, and they're just going forward from there.
Lee says the state is working with the local tribe to ensure those remaining have supplies to ride out the flood until the ice jam gives way. The sole survivor of a Coast Guard helicopter crash has been denied promotion, possibly ending his military career. Lieutenant Lance Leone was one of four people aboard an Air Station Sitka helicopter when it crashed off the coast of Washington State in 2010. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano signed an order last week removing him from the list of officers scheduled for promotion. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
In August, Leone was passed over for promotion to lieutenant commander. He appealed, and the case made its way up to Napolitano's desk. As the U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security, she oversees the Coast Guard. Napolitano issued her decision May 23rd, upholding a November ruling on the case.
The military is what is affectionately known as an up or out system.
John Smith is Leone's civilian attorney.
If you don't get promoted, you will not be able to stay in the service in whatever capacity, in instances.
So the denial of his promotion could signal the beginning of the end for Leone's career. That's not to say the door is closed on him yet. He's up for another regularly scheduled promotion review in August, and Smith says they could also ask the Coast Guard board that handles military records to remove the negative reports from Leone's official file.
It's possible that he could get promoted. He's gotten two more officer evaluation reports since he was taken off the list, both of which are stellar. So there's a chance, but not much of one.
Leone was co-pilot of an H-60 helicopter en route from Astoria, Oregon to Sitka when it crashed. The Hilo was flying fast and low and off of its flight plan when it clipped some Coast Guard wires between the mainland and James Island and went into the water below. Three of the four people aboard died, and in late 2011, the Coast Guard filed charges against Leone. Those charges were ultimately dismissed, but the Coast Guard officially reprimanded Leone. They said he contributed to the accident by failing to question the pilot's sudden change of course. Leone and his team maintain there was nothing he could have done to prevent the accident and that he was operating within the normal bounds of his training. They blame the Coast Guard for not removing the wires across the channel, which were no longer in use and had been the source of accidents in the past.
I get so close to accomplishing the next goal, and then it just is pulled away.
That is Lance Leone. He has not flown since the accident and is now working a Coast Guard desk job in San Antonio, Texas. He says he plans to continue fighting for a promotion.
I was surprised, but I'm not totally disheartened by the fact that it happened. I believe everything happens for a reason, and I think I have to continue this path and follow through and make sure that the right thing does eventually happen.
Smith, the attorney, has stronger words about Leone's non-promotion.
This action is vindictive, nothing short of vindictive. I think that the Coast Guard leadership chose Lieutenant Leone as a scapegoat.
The Coast Guard says its actions are about standards, not scapegoats. Carlos Diaz is a spokesman for the Coast Guard based at headquarters in Washington, D.C.
This is an unfortunate situation. Nobody really wins, but again, the Coast Guard needs to be consistent with the review process and the way they keep their standards.
Diaz cited the Coast Guard's final report on the 2010 accident, the document that said Leone was partly at fault for the crash. He said the results of that report require the Coast Guard to take action.
People expect us to have high standards, especially in the aviation community, where, you know, it is a really unforgiving business. And unfortunately, in this case, we have seen what can happen, how dangerous can be.
Leone, meanwhile, says he's still hoping to advance to lieutenant commander, but that he's also starting to consider his options after the Coast Guard. If he's passed over again in August, Smith says Leone will have about a year left. And he says whatever happens, he believes his client will be okay.
Lieutenant Leone is going to succeed at whatever he does. He just hopes, and I hope for him, that it will be in the Coast Guard.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Two Tanana City officials have been charged with taking federal property for personal gain. Tanana City Manager Alfred R. Bear Ketzler and City Expediter Alfred McQuestion Fabian have been indicted on federal wire fraud and theft charges. Assistant U.S. Attorney Steve Scrocky says the men are accused of selling equipment, including trucks, forklifts, and bulldozers, made available to the city through a federal surplus program.
Federal surplus property and then covertly essentially sold it to other people and used the money for themselves and on occasion used the property for their own benefit as well.
The indictment alleges the pair sold equipment valued at nearly $1 million to make at least $122,000 for themselves. They're also accused of selling $3,600 in equipment for personal use. Scrocky would not say how the federal government learned of the illegal activity, which is alleged to have occurred between December 2009 and November of last year. He adds the equipment sales were advertised by word of mouth, but buyers are not suspected of any wrongdoing at this point.
There's a number of buyers out there who are probably innocent purchasers, and right now the investigation is just looking to identify who they might be if they have that type of equipment, but there's nothing in coming forward that people will be in trouble for buying this when they didn't know it was stolen.
Ketzler and Fabian could face decades in prison and more than $1 million in fines if convicted. An arraignment has not been scheduled. Ketzler has long managed the city of Tanana and has been successful in securing government grants to make positive changes in the Bush community, including alternative energy projects and tank farm upgrades. He did not respond to a phone call for comment, and no one answered at the city of Tanana office. The longtime athletic director of the University of Alaska Anchorage has been fired. Steve Cobb was fired by the university today. The action follows tumultuous weeks and questions over the handling by Cobb and the university of a 2011 incident in which former hockey coach Dave Shayak struck a player with his stick during a practice. Shayak was fired in March after 8 seasons without a winning record. Cobb received no confidence votes from the UAA Hockey Alumni Association and the Alaska State Hockey Association. Both groups said Cobb was out of touch with the hockey community. Until an interim is named, Cobb will be replaced by Tim McDiffitt, the school's senior associate athletic director. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a documentary raises awareness of military contamination.
The people that we trusted, our leaders, the people that were responsible for protecting us from this stuff, didn't.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The U.S. Forest Service says states like Alaska that participate in the Secure Rural Schools program owe the federal government money. Local governments throughout the state use the money to pay for schools and all sorts of rural development projects. Officials with the Forest Service say budget cuts are forcing them to ask for the payments back. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it's causing a congressional backlash.
Congress created the Secure Rural Schools program in 2000 to help regions stung by the slowdown in logging. It gives money to some 700 communities across the country, from Puerto Rico to Southeast Alaska. It's especially important there, where the commercial timber industry has all but idled since the 1990s.
They didn't do anything wrong. Those communities just are located in a national forest.
Bruce Hunter is the Associate Executive Director of the School Superintendents Association. He says communities located on federal land took it on the chin when the government ended large-scale logging during the Clinton years.
Timber harvest had resulted in monies to the counties, royalty monies to the counties.
And without that money, local governments can't pay for schools. To be clear, it's not just education that gets money. Local governments divvy it up between schools and infrastructure projects, roads, bridges, anything that would normally be paid for with tax dollars. Beth Pendleton is the regional forester for Alaska. She says the village of Cake used about $85,000 to reconstruct a 0.8-mile trail on the Hamilton Creek estuary, a trail she says gets used for both subsistence and sport fishing and hunting.
The contract for that work went to a small firm in Ketchikan, so it provided for some local jobs and also provided the use of locally milled Alaska yellow cedar for the boardwalk trail surfacing project.
Local communities have come to rely on the money because they can't tax federal land. So it took more than a few by surprise when Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell fired off a letter to governors saying he needs the money back. In January, the Forest Service began giving out the payments. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden chairs the Senate Natural Resources Committee. He asked Tidwell what happens if the governors choose not to return the money.
A lot of these communities just have no room, just no flexibility. What will happen then?
Well, I'm not the expert here, but it's my understanding that if the funds aren't returned the day that they're due, that there will be penalties, there's interest payments. that will occur.
Did you catch that last line? The federal government plans on charging interest on money it gave the states. Senator Lisa Murkowski calls the move adding insult to injury.
The revenues that we've given you, that you anticipated, that you budgeted for, we're going to claw that back. And if you can't return that money, then we're going to ding you with penalties and fines that they further can't pay. For heaven's sakes, we have got to figure out a better path forward than that.
Lawmakers across the West, states with large tracts of federal land, are screaming politics. The Forest Service's Tidwell says the automatic spending cuts Congress approved are forcing him to ask for the money back. On top of that, the amount of money has been declining. Alaska took in more than $22 million in 2009. That dropped about $7 million by 2012. Bruce Hunter questions the motive behind the Forest Service's move, especially since the money was allocated in 2012, but sequester came this year. And that creates a brand new Washington phrase, retroactive sequestration.
They knew all this was coming. This is a crazy way to do business. And if you're going to do sequestration, take it out beforehand or don't give the full amount out immediately.
Many worry rural governments will see less and less over the next 9 years because the Budget Control Act, the legislation creating sequester, lasts for a decade. And those same people worry whether the Secure Rural Schools program will get reauthorized this year. There's no movement on that just yet. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Civilian workers at Alaska's military installations are being formally notified that they'll be required to take up to 11 days off work, unpaid, by October 1st to comply with federal budget cuts mandated through the sequester process. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Fort Wainwright spokeswoman Linda Douglas says details are still sketchy on the furloughs that the post's civilian workers will be required to take between July 8th and September 30th, the end of the federal fiscal year. Douglas says the post's workers this week are being given the first formal, though preliminary, notice about the furloughs.
We expect about 365 people at Fort Wainwright to be affected by the furlough.
Alaska's biggest military installation will naturally sustain the largest number of furloughs. Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson officials said this afternoon they began providing their workforce as of Tuesday with information that about 1,930 workers will be affected. Eielson Air Force Base spokesman Captain Joost Verdijn says about 320 civilian workers at the base are likely to be furloughed. Fort Greely spokeswoman Deborah Coble says about 165 employees at the post could be affected, but she says that does not include the number of those who may be exempted because they work in emergency services or other jobs related to health and safety. Verdijn says 28 Eielson civilians who work at mission essential jobs already have been exempted.
These are employees who are in critical areas for Eielson, areas that we can't afford for them to not be there. Specifically, they belong to three different areas. The first part is the base power plant, also the child development center, child care to be provided for military professionals, and lastly is the sexual assault response coordinator. We have a civilian in that office as well, and that's an office we would like to keep fully manned.
Douglas says Army policy will require civilian workers to take the furloughs discontinuously, meaning all 11 days can't be taken off all at once. But she says exceptions may be granted by the post commander on a case-by-case basis. Civilian contractor personnel will not be required to take the furloughs. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska is joining 10 other states in opposing cuts to federal royalty payments. When resources are extracted from federal lands, states are usually entitled to 50% of the royalties. But because of sequestration, their portion is being reduced by 5%. Despite being energy rich, Alaska doesn't get much money from this royalty sharing scheme because there isn't a lot of drilling happening on federal lands. Last year, Alaska only received $16 million in federal receipts, while Wyoming received close to $1 billion. So the cut isn't expected to have much of an effect on the state's budget. Even so, Alaska is standing by the other members of the Energy Producing States Coalition in pushing back against the royalty reduction. State Senator Kathy Geisel is the chair-elect of the coalition, and she compares what the federal government is doing to theft.
If there's a contract in place between two individuals and one individual is not honoring that contract, and is retaining money that's owed to the other person, does that not equate to stealing?
Giesel adds that a policy of reducing states' royalty shares would hurt Alaska more if the federal government increased activity at NPRA or if it opened ANWR to drilling. The Office of Natural Resources Revenue, which handles the royalty payments, says they understand the hardships sequestration is causing states, but they need to enforce the cuts to comply with federal law. Bills that would restore the 50-50 split in royalty payments were recently introduced in the U.S. House and the Senate.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Don't wait to make your home more energy smart. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Home Energy Rebate Program will reimburse you for energy efficiency improvements. And if you don't have the upfront cash to make the investment, financing is available through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Start saving money and energy today. Sign up at akrebate.com or call 877-257-3228. This message sponsored by AHFC.
A former Marine Corps Master Sergeant is in Alaska visiting communities to talk about military toxins and the potential health risks of those exposed. Jerry Ensminger spent 25 years in the Marines, but a local television news story about a drinking water contamination that became a Superfund site at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina changed his life.
Here I am. I retired in that area, and that was the only reason I heard that news report. All these other people that had been exposed to Camp Lejeune were now, it was a transient population. These people were literally spread out all over the world. My mission was to get this word out. These other people who have that nagging question of what happened to me or what happened to my family member, they deserved a possible answer.
Ensminger's wife was pregnant when he was stationed at Camp Lejeune. Their daughter Janie died of leukemia at age 9. He believes there may be a link between the contamination and his daughter's cancer. He says there has also been a high rate of male breast cancer among service members who were stationed there before the toxins were identified.
We just found the 85th man, and the only thing these men have in common is that they either lived or worked or were stationed at Camp Lejeune.
Ensminger is in Alaska to visit military contamination sites here and answer questions at the screening of Semper Fi, Always Faithful, a documentary about the polluted drinking water at Camp Lejeune. The contamination, possibly from asbestos-coated cement water lines and other chemicals, was present from the early 1950s to the late 80s. President Obama signed the Janie Ensminger Act last year. The act, named for Ensminger's deceased daughter, covers those who lived or worked at Camp Lejeune from 1957 to 1987. Health officials believe as many as 1 million people may have been exposed. On a website listing information about the Camp Lejeune contamination, the Marine Corps says its goal is to use the best science to get families the answers they deserve. Ensminger says he's proud of his military service, but he feels betrayed by defense leadership.
People try to paint anybody who speaks out against the military about contamination, environmental pollution, they try to paint you as unpatriotic. Well, they have a hard time painting me that way. You know, I spent a quarter of a century of my life defending this nation in the Marine Corps. I was a former Marine drill instructor. Now, you come tell me I'm unpatriotic.
A screening of Semper Fi, Always Faithful, will be this evening at the Anchorage Museum at 6:30. Ensminger will be in Fairbanks tomorrow at 7 at the Pioneer Park Theater. He'll also travel to Nome and St. Lawrence Island, where cleanup of military toxins there is still ongoing. Links to Ensminger's speaking schedule and the Camp Lejeune information is at our website, alaskapublic.org. The University of Alaska Fairbanks is considering another addition to its growing array of outdoor recreational facilities, a roller ski loop. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Roller skiing is one of those funky niche activities that some people consider goofy, but if you're a Nordic racer, it's the best way to train in the off-season. That is, unless you crash or worse, get hit by a vehicle. The University of Alaska Fairbanks Roller Ski Loop proposal is the latest outdoor recreation project taken up by UAF Vice Chancellor for University and Student Advancement, Mike Sfraga.
It's a natural progression for us as a ski community and as a ski campus. If you drive around town or on campus in the summer, you will come across roller skiers, and it's a safety issue with gravel on the road, with cars, with traffic. They don't mix all that well.
Sfraga is also behind a new outdoor climbing wall, broom ball rink, and ski and snowboard terrain park. The climbing wall offers both summer rock and winter ice climbing, and Sfraga says the proposed roller ski loop could also be dual season.
Could double in the winter, complementary to the UAF and community ski trails. Perhaps have access to lights and the ability to make snow early in the ski season.
Sfraga says the project idea came from the ski community, led by UAF Nordic coach Scott Jerome. Jerome says safety is the primary concern with roller skiing on area roads and bike paths, but stresses a roller ski loop has to be designed for proper training.
I'm very happy that the administration is supportive, but one thing I've made clear is that if we don't have the necessary terrain, it won't get used. I mean, if it's a pancake flat, short loop, it just won't get used, and it would be an entire waste of money. So we need to have uphills that simulate what we see on cross-country ski race courses.
Jerome says a 3 to 5 kilometer course with extended climbs, safe downhills, and banked corners would be ideal, adding he knows of no other university in the country that has a dedicated on-campus roller ski track. UAF Sfraga says the project will take time to design and raise money for. It's coming during a period of major construction on the Fairbanks campus. There's no specific location or cost estimate. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Tim Ellis in Delta. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.